They were called the Vorvis Aconiae, thieves in law. They had their own codes and hierarchies that were expressed in the complex tattoos on their bodies. The tattoos also expressed their fundamental belief that in a society where ideology controlled the minds of everyone, the only way to step outside the system was through violent crime. But then at the start of 1974, the Soviet leaders discovered what Solzhenitsyn had been writing. They debated whether to shoot him, but decided instead to expel him to the West. They also decided to take the opportunity to get rid of some of the other dissidents as well. Edward Limonov and Yelena were summoned to KGB headquarters and told that they were being sent to New York. While many of the leading criminals, the Vorvis Aconiae, were taken from the prisons and put on planes to New York as well, the Soviets told the Americans that they were another group of Jews who were being allowed to emigrate.
You're gonna miss, you sure are.
Most of the Russian criminals set up home in Brighton Beach, just outside New York. They created their own organization called the Potato Bag Gang.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, and particularly the ladies, this station takes great pleasure in bringing you that little Frenchman who's been tickling your palates all over this universe, our own fresh chef.
Hello, lady. Take off your dress, slip into someone comfortable, and tie up your little apron. Be ready for some French cooking. And I'm your host, the French fresh chef. Today, lady. Thank you.
Bonjour.
Bonjour, chérie. Today, lady, potatoes in syrup. You will need 1/2 pound of slag. This is skinned slag. That is, you know, you mustn't pick the pulpy ones, although it's spotted with gray. It's needlessly expensive, and you won't be satisfied. We need 1 ounce of very sweet, dry, crystallized sugar. 2 pounds of potatoes, soft with yellow skin. And, of course, wine of sufficient quantity. Yeah, we are now ready to begin. Step one, the peeling. Take it off. Take it all off. Oh, thank you. Now, step two. Intricately, ladies, gently. Disengage and take the potatoes into small dimensions, like this. Let them to cook during 10 minutes in boiling wine and hot oil, lightly perfumed. I'm using my favorite wine, of course, on the Thunderbird label, Nippon Cadet Hot 69. Now, step three, ladies, taste them. And pour the potatoes in cold water to make goose pimples. Good, now taste them again. Then, and this is very important, that you do it loving them. You must eplush them. Finally, slip them into a casserole. Cover it with this crystallized sugar. Oh, the entire potatoes, please. Remember now, cover them with water and let it set for sufficient time to be very sweet, just until the potatoes become transparent. Serve them cold, like dessert. That's it, ladies. Eat hearty. And until next week, my Sylvan beauties, this is the fresh chef. Saying bon appetit.
Ginsburg!
It was the start of the modern Russian mafia in America. Limonov and Yelena were helped by Russian emigre writers and artists already in Manhattan. And they soon became a glamorous couple, invited to parties by rich Americans who wanted to meet Soviet dissidents. But the New York Limonov had arrived in was not the city of his dreams. Much of it was falling apart, with gangs burning down whole buildings for insurance claims. But a strange, unreal mood spread through the ruins.
this morning on our way into work, we had a report that the police had located a carcass on in a street on 172nd and Bryant. It turned out to be a stripped carcass of a gorilla. It was headless, and the fur was removed, skin was removed. South Bronx.
There was also a mood of paranoia spreading through America. Nixon's own paranoia had been exposed by the Watergate scandal. But in its wake, all kinds of other revelations came out, of dark secrets in the political world that had been kept hidden from the people. That for 20 years, the CIA had been planning assassinations and overthrowing leaders of foreign governments all around the world, using poisons and specially made secret weapons.
Don't point it at me. Does this pistol fire the dart?
Yes, it does, Mr. Chairman. And a special one was developed which would be able to enter the target without perception.
As a murder instrument, that's about as efficient as you can get, isn't it?
Yes.
The uncertainty even infected those who had previously ridiculed all conspiracy theories. 6 years before, Kerry Thornley had begun Operation Mind. He and his friend Greg Hill had planted fake conspiracy theories in the press and in underground magazines, alleging that the Illuminati were the secret organization behind all the assassinations in America. Their aim was to make people see how absurd all such theories were. But one day in New York, Thornley thought that he recognized the picture of one of the Watergate burglars on a magazine stand. He was certain he had met him 20 years before in New Orleans. Back then, Thornley had been friends with Lee Harvey Oswald. They had met when they were Marines together. Thornley had then lived in New Orleans, the same city that Oswald had lived in before the assassination. And he had met people there who later became suspects in the Kennedy conspiracy. Thornley had always seen these as coincidences. But in the new mood, he started to doubt.
I had met Guy Bannister, a suspect in the Garrison probe. I had met Clay Shaw 2 weeks before the assassination, and a discussion of my book about Oswald, the Idle Warriors, was involved. I had even worked in a restaurant where Oswald had lived in his youth with his mother right upstairs, mm-hmm. right in the same building. So there were meaningful coincidences and meaningless coincidences, but I could not explain all these weird coincidences.
But at the same time, the fake conspiracy theories that Thornley had been spreading into American culture with Operation Mindfuck ever since the late 1960s started to be believed as well, because the real conspiracies were so extraordinary. Stories about the Illuminati and a plot to create a new world order began to get mixed up with revelations about brainwashing and secret mind control programs run by the CIA. And the line between the reality of political corruption and a dream world of conspiracy theories started to get blurred in America. But the sense of uncertainty and a feeling that systems might be out of control was also creeping into other areas. A group of climate scientists had begun to argue that the world might be on the edge of another dramatic change. That there might be a cataclysmic crisis coming, and that the reason this time was human activity. In the 1970s, there seemed to be dramatic shifts happening in the climate. In regions near the equator, there were droughts and famines. But in the Arctic regions, it was getting colder. Something was happening, but no one knew what. One group said that there was going to be a dramatic cooling because the dust and smoke spreading around the world was blocking out the sunlight.
A man-made dust pall is spreading over the Earth. This dust blots out the sun and causes cooling on a worldwide scale. Not all scientists agree with this theory. I hope it's wrong myself, but there is no doubting its seriousness. For if this is correct, millions of people will be destined for chronic famine.
But others said the very opposite was about to happen. There was more and more carbon dioxide being pumped into the atmosphere. That would trap the heat, and the world would grow hotter. And the key force behind that was the hydrocarbon, oil. In the mid-1970s, oil was about to play a crucial role that would increase the uncertain mood that today has come to dominate Western societies. A feeling that we are somehow surrounded by global systems, both natural and those made by humans themselves, that are beyond control. Systems so complex and unpredictable that they make a mockery of the idea that national governments can shape and control the world. A 100 years before, coal had done the same. It had brought millions of people into the new industrial cities, where they worked for the men who owned the vast wealth that the coal had created.
Did you look at the mouth of that gift horse?
Senator Dudley, have you met Boyle M. Owl, president of the Bowel Oil Company?
How do you do?
How do you do what?
That's a great joke. Say, didn't we spend a weekend at Ted Klamstruck's Nig Island Retreat?
That's right. It's with Prick and Pat Ort.
Remember the brush was there, the writer's wife?
Well, the pipe.
That was the weekend we played Hide the Housekeeper.
Right, an old body lost.
Yeah, she's still lost. Well, gentlemen, ladies, fellow rich people. I see that both of Mickey's hands are pointing to 12. That means... Oh, shut up, Dud. I see that it's now 6 a.m. in Goonrat, where the gumboat Matilda Briggs, under my secret orders, is now docking with a hold full of Dudley Pignuts from the Senator's own Dudley Rubber Company, which I own.
You know, those natives have to have a constant supply of pignuts or they go out of their
heads. Yes, yes. Well, you see, this move diverts the world's supply of genuine pignut oil to the Chicago breweries of our good friend here, Boyle M. Owl, who I own.
I'm proud to be an owned man.
Yes. And with that much oil beer in the American working man, he'll be more than glad to turn out the lamps of the world.
You carry the big whip.
Wick. That's a wick. The Acme Whip Wick.
Why, that little gadget will blacken peasants' houses throughout the globe.
And where there's smoke, there's work. Yes, gentlemen. But the pignut swindle is peanuts.
And that money was so powerful that it seemed to control everything. Not just people's lives, but politics as well. But slowly, out of that, came a challenge to that power, based on the workers organizing together. And from that came the idea of mass democracy, that the role of politicians was to represent the mass of the people against the powerful. But now, oil was about to start something that was going to undermine that idea.
This is King Faisal of Saudi Arabia. He's going to have a great deal to say in the next few years about the way you live. He rules over a desert kingdom of 6 million people. In this decade of the oil shortage, he's one of the most powerful men in the world. Under these sands, there are proved deposits of 160 billion barrels of oil.
Starting in 1973, the Arab countries, led by King Faisal, decided to use oil as a weapon. They wanted to force America to stop supporting Israel. And they did with oil just what the miners had done with coal in the past. The Arabs blocked supplies and then suddenly raised the price 4 times. It was a dramatic exercise of power, and it caused chaos in the American economy.
As a friend of the United States, we are deeply concerned that if the United States does not change its policy in the Middle East and continues to side with Zionism, then I'm afraid such course of action will affect our relations with our American friends, because it will place us in an untenable position in the Arab world and vis-a-vis the countries which Zionism seeks to destroy.
For almost three decades, we have been the richest, most powerful nation on earth. Now, a nation of 6 million warns us we must change our foreign policy if we want full gas tanks.
It had a dramatic effect. Money suddenly poured into the Arab world. Within 3 years, Saudi Arabia had more foreign currency than Japan, Germany, and the United States put together. But the Arab governments had no idea what to do with this vast new wealth. So they turned for help to the Western banks. The banks realized that they could take these petrodollars and turn them into a new kind of international currency, free of all government control. And soon, politicians from all around the world were coming to the new headquarters of the Western banks to elaborate signing ceremonies, where they borrowed billions of the petrodollars. That global financial system that President Nixon had created by accident a few years before now became a giant force, one that held the destiny of millions of people in its hands. And politicians became increasingly convinced they couldn't control. And the money started to take charge of politics once again.
Maybe it took all, even Fox News couldn't turn away from what it looked like when those Goldman sack of crap people and the Lehman and Waite brothers were up there obfuscating and not admitting the fact that they had just been defrauding us.
You know, it's a wonderful thing. Vikings, of course, sack. Huns, sack. Well, now we know that Goldman's sacks too. Yeah, it's but... when you're dealing in the infra-thin of the stock market, derivatives of things that are, you know, that have no existence, it's truly ones and zeros, right? It's right. All the same ones and zeros world. And guys who know how to run the ones and zeros world game the system. There's no question about that. Everybody knows it. That's what they do. If they game it by a penny a day, on, you know, they're billionaires by the end of the week, these people.
Well, there's a difference between gaming, which I understand, which is like figuring out the edge. You know, is it technical? Is it a Fibonacci wave, or is it, you know, is it the moon? You know, or is it just because I found out that guy is, you know, like cheating?
I think I would call that gaming. You call up the guy who's going to invest $10 billion with you, you know, and you say, what would you like to invest in? And he said, these crap stocks. Because they're going to go down. He said, yes, how many shares would you like to get? You know, and then the evil email leaks out where the guy say, well, we really, I don't know. We're going to talk to the lawyers again because we're,
Well, you see, the thing is, in the Great Depression, because I think we're entering the great global, let's say, restructuring, particularly with the euro going entirely into the tank.
The global letdown.
Global letdown, fine. Is that in 29, so I'm not calling it the Great Depression, of course, marketing-wise, it would have to be the Greater Depression. Right, that, which means the greatest was somewhere down the
Great
line.
Great Depression 2.
Yeah. the sequel. Sequels are never as good as the originals.
No.
So in 1929, the collapse came because of overspeculation. There's a famous story about Bernard Baruch, who was the big financier, and he had a big home out on Long Island. And he's driving out one day. This is September 2, 1929. And he stops to get gas. This little rural gas station guy comes out and says, well, fill it up. And the guy's talking. And all of a sudden he turns to Baruch and says, you know, I sure like that RCA. That's a really good stock. And Baruch said to himself, if this man is speculating in stocks, there's a real problem. And he went back and he put all of his stocks into money, cashed them all in, and he was totally liquid when the thing fell. So that was because the little guys were speculating. That's not what's happening now. It's because Lehman Brothers are criminals. They put $40 billion on their books that weren't there. Goldman Sachs is saying, hey, widows and orphans, let me sell you this shitty deal. Senator Levin, I'm just quoting him.
Yeah. Thank you, Senator.
But it was only the beginning. Because another component was about to be fitted into this growing new system of power. In China, as Mao approached death, Jiang Qing was still determined to take his place as the leader. But there was one person who was equally determined to stop her. He was called Deng Xiaoping. Deng was one of the original revolutionaries, and he had been sidelined during the Cultural Revolution. But now, Deng believed that if Jiang Qing was allowed to take power, it would be a disaster for China, and the country could splinter into civil war. An anonymous poem appeared on a wall in Tiananmen Square. It was obviously addressed to Jiang Qing. Lady X, it said, "You are insane. To be empress is your ambition. Instead, take this mirror and see what you are really like. You deceive your superiors and you delude your subordinates. Yet for types like you, good times won't last." Then Mao died. Jiang Qing came on her own, dressed in black. She was already preparing to take power with three others of the leadership. They were called the Gang of Four. But another group, backed by Deng Xiaoping, set out to destroy them. Wall posters went up all across China, attacking the Gang of Four, claiming that as well as being corrupt, they were really working for the CIA to undermine China.
When Jiang Qing came to Ta Chai, there seemed to be no end to her whims. Now she wanted her room sprayed with perfume. Then she wanted more carpets on the floor. And for curtains, she wanted to have special ones of a particular dark color. Jiang Qing and company demanded complete quietitude. No one should laugh or talk loudly. Planes at a nearby airport had to stop their sorties. People had to be sent uphill to beat the woods to drive the birds away.
And 4 weeks after Mao's death, army units came in the middle of the night and arrested Jiang Qing. She was put in an underground cell next to the refrigeration unit that was holding Mao's body. She later tried to commit suicide by hitting her head against the wall. So the soldiers covered the walls with rubber. Within 18 months, Deng Xiaoping defeated all other rivals, and he took power in China. The first thing he did was wipe the past everywhere. In Shanghai, the giant sign that said, "Long live the victory of Chairman Mao's Revolutionary Road," was taken down. While outside the Department of Public Tranquility in Beijing, which in reality was the headquarters of the secret police, the thoughts of Chairman Mao were also removed. Deng then set out to create a new kind of revolution. He was going to bring capitalism into China, but the state would control and manage the whole system. His aim was simple. Money would replace the old revolutionary dreams. It was less dangerous. But he was going to use it to restore China's power. Deng Xiaoping knew that in the 19th century, the British had used drugs to control the Chinese. They had brought opium to China. It led to what the Chinese called the Century of Humiliation. now, Deng was determined to reverse that, to reassert China's power. You couldn't use drugs, because the Americans already had their own drugs. Instead, he was going to use the mass mobilization of the Chinese people to invent another force that would be the equivalent of opium. A kind of mass consumerism never seen before in the world, driven by goods so cheap that everyone in the West would want them.
I want to get China out of my life. It's a tough one. Chinese goods are everywhere. I'm sure if I checked out my labels, half of what I'm wearing or more is Chinese. It's easy enough to go to the grocery store and say, I'm not buying any Chinese vegetables. That's easy to get away with and a good thing, too. But I've got to find a way to get China out of my life. I mean, people used to make fun of all the Japanese goods. Japanese don't torture people like this, see? They just don't do it. And I got China all over me. And there's got to be a way to tell these people they've got to stop. This is hideous. This is just not acceptable. So from now on, I am going to de-Chinify myself in some way. I'll give you a progress report on the amount of Chinois that I'm able to, shall we say, vet from my life wardrobe.
China, man. China, you know, it used to be that we didn't know anything about China at all, except there was this Mao. There was this Mao there, and there was this gigantic red country. Huge, huge, bigger even than the Soviet Union. Gigantic. Hey, the Soviet Union. Yeah. Haven't said that in years.
No, no. The word, in fact, there's a whole generation growing up to whom the word Soviet would mean nothing.
Oh, except in America. Oh, yeah, Obama, the Soviet agent.
Oh, that's
Come
right,
on,
he's the Soviet.
Please, let's get with it, get hip.
And that's true. Ted Nugent did accuse Obama also of being Mao, this being a Maoist government, so that'll keep Mao alive.
Mao and Che, sure. Mao and Che. It sounds like a new Chinese dish. Would you like a Mao and Che?
I have them on you. Red hot, red hot, international dish. Never know where it's going to explode in you. When I was in the advertising business, you know, they said you cannot make any references in ads. This was radio ads for movies. Anything that's more than 17 years old, because our target audience won't know what you're talking about. But now that Obama is accused of being Soviet, a socialist, and Mao, these words are back.
Yep, they've all returned. It's really strange. And, you know, otherwise, I got to tell you, the daffodils are out there, and the tulips are blooming, and the alders are all in green, and it's spring out there, Pete.
Well, there doesn't seem to be any politics in nature. Isn't that interesting? I mean, the daffodils are not neither politically correct or politically incorrect. They're nothing but intent. It's what I love about nature, is that it's nothing but intent. There's no attitude. There's no specific program. Well, I guess survival of the fittest or something like that, I guess, if you go into that.
But I don't think daffodils are thinking about survival of the fittest, daffodil man.
No.
They're just hanging, you know what I mean?
Yeah, they're already the fittest.
There
In
you
fact,
go.
They came up, they're bulbs, you know, they're doing just fine. So, yes, enough of the whole Chinese thing. I tell you, though, China, I got to tell you, it's really, really bizarre. When I was there doing a little speech about 2 years ago, I stepped outside of my hotel in Shanghai, and there were 250,000 people on the street. Whoa. And they're real close. I mean, they have different sense of space, because there is none. And I'm walking down the street, and people are bumping up, and people are going by saying, can I try my English out on you? And then half of them are trying out their English, and the other half are trying to proposition you. It's a very, very strange place.
Whole cities were going to be built in China, made just one kind of product. They would be shipped in vast quantities to the West. You gave up on utopian ideas about the future and didn't believe in anything any longer, apart from the money. And his allies in this would be the Western banks and their new system of global lending. Because the banks would lend millions of people in the West the money to buy the Chinese goods. just like they had been lending to governments all around the world. It was going to be the perfect system. Edward Limonov was now all alone in New York. He had published an article attacking the other émigrés, so they all dropped him. Then Yelena, the woman he loved more than anything else in the world, met a photographer who promised to make her a model. He seduced her, and she left Limonov. Without love or money, Limonov became destitute. He lived in the cheapest hotel, surrounded by prostitutes and drug addicts. And he spent his days and nights wandering the city, alone. While all around him, the newly powerful banks were building their headquarters among the old ruins. And one day in Central Park, looking at the people all around him, Limonov decided that he was going to write a novel, but one that would have him as the central figure. It would be about the real experience of America, not the fake democracy. In the book, he described watching Americans in a cafe where he was working as a waiter. "It is they," he wrote, "who have introduced a plague into this world. The plague of money. The disease of money. The plague of buying and selling is their handiwork. I hate this system. And I am not ashamed that my hatred has sprung from my wife's betrayal. I'm going to blow up your world." The book, called It's Me, Eddie, gave a picture of a new reality that Limonov saw emerging from under the surface of America's everyday life.
Eddie, are you kidding? I've seen you on my TV. Eddie, are you kidding? The people always ask me. I saw your double mitts. I thought they were the pits. You threw it in a bag, and then you sent me home. What? Eddie, are you kidding? No, no, Eddie, are you kidding? No, no.
People think they are free, but really, they are becoming like simplified robots, following the rules of money, limited to satisfying only those desires that can be bought and sold. Every publisher he sent it to refused to publish it. But there was another person, at the very top of America, in the White House itself, who was also about to expose a frightening reality underneath the surface of the society. In 1978, the president's wife, Betty Ford, revealed that she had become addicted to Valium. An addiction that she said had taken her into a strange state, where even her sense of time had become dislocated.
As I look back, it was December, about a year ago, when I realized that there were some sort of blank spots where I had a hard time putting events in their separate slots in time. To me, it was marvelous and beautiful, but to the family, I was beginning to show signs of over-medication.
Betty Ford's admission had a dramatic effect. In its wake, stories began to pour out of people all across America who were also addicted to Valium. It seemed that there was a private, hidden world of anxiety behind the public faces that affected millions of people. But Arthur Sackler, who in the 1960s had promoted Valium as beneficial and non-addictive, was unrepentant. And a company that he and his two brothers had started was about to develop a new drug, a synthetic form of opium called OxyContin. And that was going to deal with the next wave of anxiety that would hit America. Over the next 20 years, as more and more factories closed because of the cheap goods coming from China, millions of people in the communities would take OxyContin because it made them feel safe, in a bubble, protected from the growing uncertainties around them. And Harry Cordill, who had represented the miners in Appalachia, became certain that the anger under the surface there was going to grow. One day, he said, it would break out and infect the whole of America.
How are you, Mrs. Belcher?
I'm
thinking.
In 1990, he discovered he had Parkinson's, and he shot himself. While Kerry Thornley had become convinced that the coincidences in his past were not coincidences, that the CIA had somehow manipulated him to set up Operation Mine. But he had no idea why. He had become lost. 20 years before, he and his friend Greg Hill had been early individualists. They believed that they could shape reality the way they wanted. But now, faced with the revelations about how intricate and complex power had become in the modern world, they felt powerless and lost. Thornley had retreated into a dream world of conspiracies, while Greg Hill had become an alcoholic and was equally lost. He wrote a letter to Thornley about how he had come to believe in nothing. "It is not injustice that overwhelms me now," he wrote, "but my sheer damn inability to know anything with any deep level of certainty. When despair is deep enough, even death seems pointless. Now I live without justice. I don't know why. I just live it. So be it." And Edward Limonov would finally get his novel, It's Me, Eddie, published in Russia. It would cause a sensation, and its dark vision of the reality behind the rhetoric of American democracy was going to influence an entire generation in Russia. It was the generation to whom the Americans would then try and sell the idea of democracy. All the talk of democracy, the book told them, was just a sham. Really, it was all about the money.
And my friend said to me, "Eddie, Eddie, what do you think of the new double knits?
Eddie, what do you think of the new double knits?"
And I tell them, I'll tell you something, frankly, my friends, when the new double knits first came out, I was not impressed. But as you can see, these pants I'm wearing are double knit. They stretch in all the right places. They're the most comfortable. Our model Twiggy here will demonstrate. I have this lovely little sear sucker. Wait a minute.
Where can I go with Gardena?
And where can I go in L.A.?
And where can I go with Rosemont?
I need some dress today. I need the knits, the double knits. I need the knits, they are the bits. I need the knits, the double knits. I'm coming over shortly because I am a portly. You promised you could fit me in a $50 suit. Right here on the Miracle Mile, we have the West's largest selection of
Portly.
Regular.
Cadet.
Tall.
And long.
Not only that, my brother Jake and little Emil and...
Sid!